And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Reed Farrell Coleman back to the program today. Reed is a novelist and poet, has won many awards, including 4 Seamus Awards and a Barry and an Anthony, and has written several series, including his much-lauded Mo Prager series and the recent Gus Murphy one. Today we'll be talking about the 5th Jesse Stone novel that he's written for the Parker Estate. It's called Robert B. Parker's Colorblind. Reed, Jesse Stone has just gotten back to Paradise, Massachusetts after a stint in rehab. How did that go for him?
Well, I'd like to say that Jesse is all about doing right. And for years and years and years, he had done everything alcoholics do. He made excuses, he made rationalizations. But to be consistent with the character, I felt eventually he needed to realize that the right thing to do would be to stop drinking, and stop drinking seriously, unlike he had in the past. So I think his struggle now, it went from struggling with drinking to struggling not to drink, and seriously for the rest of his life. So you can only write the scene of someone getting drunk so many times before it gets boring for the writer and boring for the reader. Like they say, you can only drag a character over the same hot coal so many times. And so I think as long as I write the series, Jesse will now be sober.
He was a good baseball player, and he's a good cop, and he was a great alcoholic.
Yeah, I think he did that better than any other two things. And so let's see how good he is at being sober.
How was the alcoholism affecting his life and his job?
Well, that's the thing. I think, you know, you hear the thing, you have to hit rock bottom before it's time to change. Jesse knew he had hit rock bottom from the previous book because the people, the women in particular, who he loved and trusted, called him selfish. And I think there are words we all have that if we're called those words, they're hot button words that will either make us angry or spring us into action. And I think Jesse never had thought of himself ever in his life as being selfish. And when both of those women told him his alcoholism was selfish, that was the thing that sparked him into saying, okay, maybe this is the right thing for me to do.
Now, what's a hot button word for RFC?
Stupid. Don't call me stupid, or I'll jump over the desk and start choking you.
The one that stung for me was pompous. I went, oh, man.
Yeah, that'll make you nuts. Yeah, pompous. I mean, won't make me choke you, but it might make me kick you.
Now, what kind of research did you do in order to investigate Jesse's alcoholism and then the path his sobriety would take?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. If you look at the front of the book, it's dedicated to Ace Atkins. So that was the alcoholism part. No, just joking.
Ace loves a tipple, though.
No, I really was just joking. Just come to a signing with a good bottle of Pappy for Ace, and he'll love you forever. No, the other person it's dedicated to is a gentleman named Tom Schreck. And Tom I've given a lot of credit to for helping me figure out how to write the series, because I'll tell this story. I've probably told this story every time we've done this interview. But when I got the job, Tom, who's a huge Parker fan and a huge Elvis fan, I called Tom up to try and figure out how to write the series. And he said, I've seen the best Elvis impersonators in the world. And there's two things you can't get away from. One, that no matter how good they are, you know they're impersonating. I mean, it's not him. And second, they can never do anything new. So that helped me decide that I wouldn't try to copy how Bob Parker wrote the series. But Tom's a very interesting guy. Not only is he a big Elvis and Parker fan, he's a New York State boxing judge, and he works in rehab. He's a counselor, a drug counselor. So the alcoholism AA part, Tom knows all about it. So Tom and I had long talks about what going to an AA meeting is like and how it is for people who stop drinking and how that works. So he was invaluable to me. The flip side is people think I write the alcoholism so well that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not. That's one of the things. I don't even like scotch. That's the thing that's crazy. So I get two reactions from my readers who care about this stuff. One is, oh, you poor man, you've stopped drinking. And the flip side is the people who send me expensive bottles of scotch and think I really like scotch because I do such a good job of discussing the romance Jesse has with scotch. So the research on the AA, that was easy. I talked to Tom. We had long talks about it. But the alcoholism, that's what being a writer is, being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and imagine what it's like. And I guess I'm good at imagining things.
Do you have someone in your life you can re-gift those gift bottles of scotch to?
There's always lots of people who will take those good bottles of scotch. There's never a problem with that.
Jesse has chosen to go to AA meetings in Boston. Is that just because he doesn't want to lose face or worry the people of Paradise by going to meetings there?
It's for two reasons. One reason is it's an Episcopal church, I believe, across the street from where his late fiance lived. So that's how he knew that church. And so in some ways, it's a way for him to remember her. It was her murder, which in fact set him off the deep end, that his drinking got so bad that it caused the other women in his life to call him selfish and spark him. So it's a way to remember his old fiance. And yes, partially, at least in the beginning of the book, he's not ready to be public about his rehab and his AA meetings. I think eventually he'll wind up going to local meetings.
Can you give us a little taste of the people that he's in his meetings with up there in the Boston?
Yeah, sure. Another reason, you know, it's not all pure chance or nostalgia that he goes there. It also gives the writer an opportunity to get him involved with more interesting people because, let's face it, an AA meeting, let's say in New York City, might be a little more interesting than an AA meeting out by where I live on Long Island. So yeah, the people he makes friends with are an ex-fence who lost his whole family named Bill, who becomes his sponsor, and a young woman, a young tattooed woman who's very attractive, but clearly she has a kind of a psycho boyfriend. And he comes to one meeting and then doesn't come again, but she keeps coming. And in some ways, the fact that he goes to this church for these AA meetings leads to a break in the case, but we'll let the readers find out about that.
Now, there's also a very attractive woman, more of Jesse's age, that's there, but the rules are you're not supposed to get into romantic relationships with people in your group.
That's right. Tom said there's a phenomenon known as 13-stepping. It's when people who go to AA meetings, you know, men generally, who start hitting on the younger women who come to the meetings and are in a very vulnerable state. It was fascinating learning this stuff because it's something I never would have thought of on my own. Jesse's always had an eye for beautiful women, and they've always had an eye for him. These people are very attracted to each other, but they realize it's not the right way to go. And I think they both realize it's not the right way to go.
Now, it's pretty on the nose that his sponsor's name is Bill, since people who go to AA are sometimes known as friends of Bill, and Bill W. being the founder.
Yes, that was a serendipitous, not mistake, but that was just a serendipitous choice on my part. And Tom pointed that out after I had named them Bill.
Now, you talked about the women in his life who had referred to him as selfish because of his drinking, and I'm sure one of those was Molly, his right hand at the Paradise Police Department.
Yes. Molly, in some ways, though, they've never had a romantic relationship, and I doubt they ever will.
But they love each other.
They love each other in a way. It's beyond family, and it's beyond friends, and it's beyond colleagues. I think Jesse has a strong moral compass, but I think he says in the book that he can set his watch by Molly. Molly makes her feelings known to him, and he trusts her above all other people in the world, I think. She is the most important person, I think, other than anyone else in the world to him is Molly. And he would be lost, I think, without her. And he thinks he'd be lost without her. And sometimes it's not an easy relationship, as it is often the case with the people you trust. I don't trust readers or people I show my book to who would I know are going to say good things about it. You have to trust someone you know. You have to believe that they'll say bad things to you as well. Like my wife, who has no trouble saying bad things about me.
But they have a true simpatico.
They do. They kind of share part of their souls with each other. And I think that's evident from no matter who writes the series, whether it was Bob Parker, Michael Brandman, or me, they've recognized and we've recognized that their relationship is crucial to the series and they share a very, very special relationship.
Now, while Jesse was in rehab, Molly had to run the department, and that wasn't her most favorite thing to do.
No, I realize that I've done one or two events before. I'm doing novel books here in Memphis, and I found myself reading a page of the opening chapter, but then going to the second chapter and reading the section where Jesse comes back to the station for the first time after returning for rehab. And, of course, they have one of their classic conversations, and Molly's quite angry at Jesse because Molly loves her job for what it is. And the last thing she wanted to ever be was the acting chief of police of the Paradise Police Department. But that's their relationship. She did it willingly because it helped him, but she wants no part of ever doing that job again.
Well, I guess her personality suits her to be the hand of the king. But what is it particularly about being in charge that she didn't enjoy?
Well, that's a funny thing, isn't it? I think we all have experienced that. It's one thing to be the assistant coach, and the players can like you and get along with you. And it's another thing to be the head coach, where you have to make decisions that you know are going to affect possibly badly people who like you and whom you like very much, but suddenly the personal relationships become less important and the health of the department becomes the most important thing. And there are very few people who want that job. Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
And I'm sure dealing with the mayor wasn't her favorite thing either.
Yes, it's not even mine, and I write her.
While Molly was in charge, a group of skinheads came to town and gave one of the new hires on the police force, Alicia, a really hard time.
And that's, I think, the genesis of the book, actually, is Alicia is the first African-American woman on the police force, the second woman on the police force. It's Alicia and Molly, but there are only 13 people on the police force. So that's a start. And as Jesse, who has worked in a big city police department in Los Angeles, realizes Paradise isn't the town it always used to be. It's not a lily white town anymore. Paradise is not a kind of resort village anymore. Boston is beginning to encroach on Paradise. People are starting to commute from Paradise to Boston and vice versa. So people,
it's gone from bread and breakfast to bedroom.
Right. It's a bedroom community, and someday you don't know. You can see, I mean, I live in a perfect example of that. I live in a town in Suffolk County, Long Island. When we moved there, when my family moved there, very few people commuted into New York from where we lived. Now, 20 miles beyond us towards the Hamptons, people commute by train and car every day. So the city, it just inevitably, as it grows, it encroaches on the communities around it. And Jesse understands that. So he's beginning to try to hire people who reflect the people who are moving into the community. And Alicia is the, and not easily though, because of course small towns, this may be too much information, but if you're running a small town and you want to hire a cop, why don't you hire a big city cop who already is retired from his or her job in the big city and already has a pension and already has medical benefits that you don't have to pay those things. You just have to pay a salary. I mean, there are legion New York City cops who've moved down to Florida who start working for small towns in Florida. But Jesse realizes, no, he wants to train the people who work for him because big city cops also come with pensions, but they also come with baggage. And Jesse doesn't want that baggage along.
And also her father was a cop?
Her father was a New York City cop.
And she aced the test.
Right. She's perfectly qualified to do this job. She's perfect for the job, and Jesse knows that.
But he had a lot of pushback.
Of course. But the politicians always push back for the very reasons I said. You know, they claim it was the pension and the experience, but of course some of it was about the color of her skin.
Now, the name of the book is Robert B. Parker's Colorblind, and that's a wish that is a fantasy in our world.
It is in our world. It is in this country. But it's not only this country. It's in the world. It's good that we recognize that it's a fantasy. It's something to dream about, but it's not something, at least in my lifetime, that's ever going to happen. You know, you've read the book, so you know why it's called Colorblind. And the first page will tell people when they read the book why it's called Colorblind.
And the cold open of the book is a young woman, a young African-American woman, running for her safety from three aggressive white men.
Yeah. Originally, when I wrote the book, the second chapter was the first chapter. And I thought, no, I think you have to open it with the crime. For one thing, it's a practical writer's reason. It's an exciting opening. It's a horror, kind of horrifying and scary opening. But it's the opening of the book. Sometimes your characters tell you what's right. Sometimes you don't tell them what to do. They tell you what to do. And that scene said that had to be the opening scene in the book.
Now, there are quite a few people, especially early on in the book, especially on the bad side of the law, these three assailants at the beginning, whose identities you kind of keep secret from us. So we kind of have to guess on what's going on.
Well, it's a mystery novel. Sometimes I don't hide who the bad guys are. But I think in the Jesse Stone books, I've always kind of enjoyed at least pulling the veil back slowly on who the bad guys are and what their motivation is. In the beginning, and I don't want to give too much away, you know, they're three white men chasing a very attractive African-American woman, but there can be a lot of reasons. They're bad people. So she might have been white. She might have been Hispanic. Maybe she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So you're not quite sure why she's a victim, but it becomes clearer as the book goes on why she was a victim and why just how bad those three men were.
I was trying to think about, you know, why I reacted so viscerally to it. And of course, you know, I read crime fiction and there's all manner of crimes and violence happening against people and why the racial element exacerbated that. And I think, you know, we've always known that violence is bad back to Cain and Abel. But with the racial aspect to it, it points to our very recent history of America sanctioning this racial violence and letting the country operate because of racial violence.
Well, here is where I thank you. I need to do a disclaimer because I don't want readers to think this is a message book. There is a message in the book, but the message is not why I wrote the book. And what's funny is I turned this book in a month before Charlottesville. So people have said, oh, you must have seen what happened in Charlottesville and you wrote the book. No, I turned it in a month before Charlottesville ever happened. It's just the way my mind works. So I want to be clear. This is not me standing on a soapbox and preaching, because the worst kinds of books, I think, and you read more books than me, you know, preaching, I don't want someone to preach to me. So the book is entertaining and scary and a lot of things. But I certainly didn't start to write this book to send a message. I used the situation, just like many other situations of things happening in the world. And this one happened to be dealing with race relations.
The Boston area has been famous for its difficult racial relations between especially Irish people and African-American people. It's been really rough over the years.
I think it's better now. It's much better now. But of course, the forced busing in the 70s, it was an issue in a lot of places. But, you know, Boston's a pretty parochial town. Their neighborhoods are very sacrosanct to them. And that was as ugly, you know, the scenes on television from the 70s in Boston were horrible. I don't tend to think it's there any worse than anybody else. You know, the 70s were and the 60s, turmoil everywhere. So, yes, there's a history of it there. But again, it's because paradise is near there. That's why it harkens back to Boston.
The assault happened, was it Swan Harbor?
Swan Harbor, the neighboring town,
right.
Yes.
So why does Jesse become involved in this investigation?
Jesse becomes involved because although the sexual assault and the beating happens in the neighboring town, and the night that Jesse comes back to town, a cross is burned on the lawn of an interracial couple who bought Jesse's old house. Jesse's moved back into town. He's got a condo now. He's a, you know, swinging bachelor. He's living in a condo. He felt as part of why he hired Alicia was to have a better pulse on things and have a more diverse department. He also wants to be closer to the pulse. He was drinking, living out alone where he could be isolated, and he's decided that he doesn't want to do that. So he sells his house, and the people who bought his house were an Indian doctor who works in Boston and a, you know, blonde, blue-eyed woman, and there's a cross burned on their lawn. So that happens almost immediately. So there's obviously something going on in and around Paradise.
I thought it was interesting, too, because in Ace Atkins' writing of the Spencer books from Robert B. Parker series, that Spencer has recently moved apartments as well. And so that both Jesse Stone and Spencer have moved, and it seems very symbolic that under y'all's pen that both of these characters have moved house.
Well, they were going to be roommates, but they couldn't agree on a place to live. And I think one of the things that Ace and I have recognized is there are 40 Spencer books. This is 17 Jesse Stone books. And having written my own long series, not nearly as long, but having written, you realize that in some points you have to change the series. You don't change the characters, but you either change the setting, you change things the characters do, i.e. going to rehab, moving. They seem like kind of weird, artificial things to do, but it really changes the focus. And I think Ace and I, people who've written our own series, recognize you have to spice things up occasionally and change things around. And this novel in particular, of course, you've read it, is what I would call a quote-unquote change novel, because there's a lot of change that happens in this novel.
When you're in that process, how do you know that you're being true to the character in that the way they change?
Well, like I said, the foundation of Jesse, who Jesse is at his core, is someone who believes in doing right, which is different than doing justice. He believes in doing right. And so it wasn't hard for me to finally get him to go to rehab, for instance, because he would someday recognize it was the right thing to do. So that's not changing him at all at his core. That is him actually at the most. That is him, the epitome of his core. He's doing the right thing, doing rehab. Why would he move? That would be consistent with Jesse because it's consistent with hiring Alicia. It's consistent with wanting to be more in touch with what's going on in town. So when you make those moves, they can't seem artificial. They can't seem like, well, I'm changing it just to change things. If Jesse shaved his head tomorrow, that would be an artificial kind of change. But the changes I've made, I hope readers understand, are organic to what the character is or who the character is.
So it's the change of circumstance in line with the character.
Right. Very good. You want to do my interviews for me from now on?
Now, when he gets to the crime scene, Captain Brian Lundquist from the state police is there, and he's the top cop when it comes to murder in the state, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's taken over for Healy. That was a change that, you know, you can't do all the changes in a series in one book because then the fans come and hunt you down. So I did make some changes. Healy's retired. You know, who knows in future books what Healy will be doing? Maybe he'll be a private investigator. You never know. So Lundquist, now having taken over for Healy, is at the murder scene. Oh, it's not yet a murder scene, but where they find the African-American woman, her body dumped in a parking lot of the high school. It harkens back to an old case, Jesse's very first case in Paradise, where a young white woman whose body was dumped in a parking lot with the word slut written across her abdomen in lipstick. And this is the same thing that's written across this woman's abdomen too, though she's not dead. She's in a coma. Whereas Healy would have recognized the similarity, Jesse kind of has to inform Lundquist that this is awfully reminiscent of something that happened in the past, in the very first book, Night Passage.
But there are conflicts about jurisdiction that come up because they are two different cities. Is there a strong county sheriff system in Massachusetts, or is it basically the state police and the local police?
It's state police and local police, though I'm no expert on it. You know, I lie for a living, so I do some research about that. People can complain about the internet all they want, but one of the things for writers that's just great is, you know, Google Massachusetts State Police, and you get pages and pages and pages. So it's kind of cool that research is much easier now than it used to be. So I suspect from my reading that it's local and the state police, and that similarly in New York, outside of New York City, because in New York City, the city cops have more power than the state cops do.
But not a whole lot of county sheriff's action going on.
No, there's some where I live. But in New York, at least, the county sheriffs are kind of the jailers and the people who throw you out of your house when you don't pay your mortgage and stuff. But I think in Massachusetts, it's usually pretty much the local police and the state police.
There's a local cop up there in Swan's Harbor named Drake Daniels that kind of strikes him wrong.
Yeah, because there are people who don't give you any information, and then there are people who give you too much information. And when people volunteer information at a crime scene, that gets a cop's attention. How do you know that? Why do you know that? This Drake, I just picked that name out of the air. He volunteers some information to Jesse that immediately gets Jesse's attention. Jesse's instincts prove to be right.
You make a joke about that, but at least in the area, we know that Drake Hall, who is a Memphis DJ, is one of the biggest Parker fans in America. So I'm assuming that's where that came from.
Yes. And I was on the radio with him this morning, and I said, yes, I made you a very bad character, but insignificant, too.
And y'all will be in conversation tonight at the bookstore.
That's correct, at Novel Books. I'm really looking forward to that.
Of course, a boyfriend comes up as an immediate suspect or a husband when there's a violent crime against a woman. So can you tell us what they make of Stephen Randisi, who is supposed to be the boyfriend of this young woman?
It's like concentric circles. You always start in the innermost circle. When there's a victim, you always first assume it's the boyfriend or the husband or the wife. It's always the people closest to the victims, because most murder victims know each other. And when you think about what the motives are for murder, you know, strong emotion, money, sex, who do you deal with mostly? It's the people closest to you. Family or boyfriends are always the first suspects. And of course, Stephen Randisi's white. So here's a pattern that Jesse notices. And it's also, he's wounded. He's missing a limb. So they're not so sure that he's the guy. But of course, he's the first suspect. It's the natural person to suspect. They're doing their job. It's a way to show they're doing their jobs right by suspecting him.
There's another unnamed person that comes into the scene, referred to as the soldier. And he likes to work in the margins and in the shadows.
Yeah. If you ask me who's the most fun character I had writing in this book, it was the soldier. Again, I've never been a soldier. I know some soldiers, but the fact is he's in some ways a very complex character because he's torn in loyalty, although it doesn't seem he is. When I was writing him, sometimes what comes out on the page is not what's going on in my head as I'm writing a character. It was very easy for me to put myself in his shoes. And I think people understand soldiers and their loyalties. And I just loved writing him. He's a very dislikable character in many ways. He's a thoroughly dislikable character. But sometimes those are the characters we like writing best. Because even if it doesn't come out on the page, I felt really sorry for him. I felt terrible for him.
That was one of the great ways you humanized him, because he was very good at what he did, but he wasn't perfect. He made mistakes. He made errors in judgment. And I thought that was a good way to humanize him.
Yeah.
He wasn't a machine at all.
Yeah. I dislike characters that are just one thing. Cardboard cutout characters. I don't like characters who are just bad. When I write a character, any character, I assume they have full internal lives. And when I used to teach writing, I would get people to become better writers by saying, imagine, however brief that character is in a book, imagine them having full lives, having secrets. It's one of the great fun things I used to do in a class, and I go, when you write this character, think of the thing that embarrasses him or her more than anything in the world, so much so that even when they think about it, it embarrasses them, or a secret they have. So if my characters seem real to the readers, it's because they're real to me. And even the bad characters, of course, I write them too. I don't say, ooh, the bad character, they're bad, so I'm not going to invest in them. They're bad, but they're just as important as the good characters. Sometimes they're more important than the good characters.
Now, we've talked about research up until this point, but I'm sure the research you had to do into white supremacist and white nationalist organizations was pretty distasteful.
It's distasteful, but it's easy. It's easy to understand their motivation, though not easy to sympathize with it. You know, fear and anger, they're the easiest emotions to tap into in people's lives. And that's what it's about. It's about fear and anger. So who doesn't understand fear and anger and hurt? They are very basic emotions. So you can couch their rhetoric any way you want. They can couch it as, you know, saving the purity of the country, however they want to couch it. But I think it reduces down to fear, anger, and hurt. Some people can deal with it as adults, and some people deal with it as striking out. It was not complex for me to understand what was going on.
I guess it's that fear of not accomplishing much in their lives that leads those that are least accomplished to believe they are the most superior.
You know, I get it. I do understand it. I don't agree with it. I think it's very misguided. And I think, you know, all that anger and all that time is going to come to nothing but violence and getting nowhere. It will just further, you know, the anger and the hurt and the pain. So I think it's a waste of time. It's a waste of human energy. But it's also a way for certain people to feel very important in the world, and they're not very important.
There is a young man who's mysterious that comes to town, but we know his name. It's Cole Slayton. And the pretty much the only thing he has when he comes to town is a backpack and the biggest chip on his shoulder ever.
Yeah. He's a character we've seen in other books by other writers. I think we know Cole Slayton. We know people who we can see are valuable people, but the boy, they carrying something around with them, you know, anger and hurt. See, to me, I like the juxtaposition of the anger and the hurt in the face of the white supremacists. And also, Cole Slayton is carrying around a lot of the same emotions, but he has one particular target for his chip, and that's Jesse Stone. Whereas the white supremacists have a very general view and loathing for, you know, blacks, Jews, whoever isn't white. Cole Slayton's loathing and dislike of authority is exemplified by one person, and that's Jesse Stone.
Now, I think we've done a really good job at avoiding kind of the bigger events that happen even fairly early on in the book, because I want the people to be able to enjoy it and not talk about that. So can you tell us a little bit about the Jesse book you're writing on right now, or the one that's going to come out next year?
The next book is called Robert B. Parker's The Bitterest Pill, and that deals with opioid addiction coming to paradise. As Vinnie Morris said, I think two or three books ago, the crime in Boston, it's going to be in paradise soon, as he warns Jesse, and his predictions coming true. It's coming true in this book, and it comes true in the next book. That's also pretty heart-wrenching, because the victims of it are often teenagers. It's certainly true on Long Island. While this year was a better year, there were an incredible amount of opioid overdoses in the last several years on Long Island. Heroin, it's a big problem. And strangely enough, the person, if you want to read about how this all came about, is Don Winslow. Because part of our opioid addiction issues have to do with the Mexican drug cartels and our own big pharmaceutical companies. It's not a big conspiracy. I'm not here to spout conspiracy theories at all. But it's really true. that as you legalize marijuana, you're taking profits away from the cartels. And they're not going to give up the profits. So they have to find a way to supplant what happened with
new markets.
New markets. And what they found out was, you know, eventually you can't buy opioids. Eventually that dries up. And so where do you get stuff to feed your addiction? Well, heroin's pretty inexpensive now.
Especially compared to the pills.
Right. And it's very pure. That was a market decision by the cartels. And it was sparked by what the thing in the world that I'm always amazed at is unanticipated consequences. And by legalizing marijuana, we've in fact, which I'm not against, it's not me preaching again, it's not me preaching, but there's unintended consequences all the time. When we legalize marijuana, we're costing somebody money, and those people don't want to give up that money. And so they found a niche, and unfortunately that niche is causing, you know, the deaths of a lot of people here. So that's what the next Jesse Stone book's about.
Now, you talked about how people confuse that you might like Scotch as much as Jesse Stone did. Did you get any readers who were looking for the albums of Terry Jester after The Hangman's Sonnet?
Yeah, I kind of wish they would, but no, unfortunately not. I love writing these books because I loved writing all the different characters, and I like Terry Jester. Now that The Hangman's Sonnet's out in paperback, maybe I can give away how Terry Jester got his name for those people who don't know. The song American Pie, there's a line, the jester on the sideline in a cast is a reference to Bob Dylan, who was very seriously injured in a motorcycle accident. And he's referred to in that song as the jester. So Terry Jester got his name kind of as an oblique reference to American Pie.
I did not know that.
Yes.
As Johnny Carson would say.
Well, I'm going to go to the Slauson cutoff and cut off a Slauson. And yeah, I miss Johnny Carson.
So are they going to let us have another Gus Murphy book?
I don't know. Right now, the pipeline is clogged by negotiations. If they unclog it, yes. I feel we need at least one more, but that's not up to me. I don't do this for free. I would do it for free, but don't tell anybody that. But, you know, I get paid to do this, and unless somebody's willing to pay me to do it, I'm not going to do it.
Have you been working on anything else instead of Gus Murphy and the Jesse Stone books?
Yes. I have been hired by the film director Michael Mann.
Oh, yeah. I remember you mentioned that last
year.
Yeah,
to write the prequel novel to the movie Heat. And boy, that's been interesting, to say the least.
How's working with Mr. Mann?
Oh, he's a brilliant guy, and we get along just fine. But our processes are different. So it's often a matter of trying to get in sync more than anything else. And plus, Hollywood is write. And I'm more of, you know, I edit as I go along, but I want to finish it and make big changes at the end. It doesn't necessarily mesh, but he's the boss, so I do what the boss says.
Now, you're also a poet. Can you give us a few lines from one of your latest poems?
I haven't written a poem in a long time.
Oh,
so no, I mean, I don't have the time. I don't have the energy to expend, because actually writing poetry, for me, expended way more energy than writing a book. It's much more concentrated.
Your love of poetry shows by using a Schiller line for at the beginning of the book.
Yes, Schiller. Anybody who's listened to the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth, you know, Freunde Schöner Gatte Funken Tachter aus Elysium. That's my German showing off, by the way. That's a Schiller poem about, you know, all humans and being joyful and together as one. The quote I use in the beginning of this book is extremely appropriate to the book, but the readers will know that only when they get to the end of the book.
Well, let us give you an ode to joy and our appreciation for coming by and sharing your book with us today.
Thanks. Every time I'm here, I love hanging out and doing this. Thanks.
I appreciate it, Reed.
All right, bye.
Reed Farrell Coleman is the author of Robert B. Parker's Colorblind, a Jesse Stone novel, which is published by Putnam. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.